This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. Good to be with you. Sven Sundgaard is going to join us a little bit later on, talk a little weather. Also, he's got his second shot. We're going to talk a little bit about that because the Moderna shot, it's interesting. It seems like my friends who have taken the Moderna shot and gotten the second one, either there's no problem or they are just wiped out. And I want to talk to him about that a little bit. We'll talk to him. That's coming up here a little bit later on. You know, it's one of my favorite days of the year, Patrick. You know that?
Twins opening day.
There you go. I you know, I'm a big Twins fan. They're down 1-0. That was the last I checked. Yeah, 1-0. In the third, Barrios is on the mound for us today. I'm hoping they'll be able to get the whole game in. I mean, it is kind of one of those things where there's a little bit of a question with the weather here, but I just do love it. It's interesting. I gotta admit, I was on the way here, I popped on the game just to hear it, and Gardenhire was on. And for everyone out there, I know this is a political station. We definitely do things in the progressive side of politics. But I want to be very clear. I love baseball and I can talk baseball. Gardenhire is one of my favorite coaches that I've ever seen. He is a fantastic manager. I think the year that it was his last year here, no one could have done what he did with what he had, and he didn't do a lot, but he managed to always get something out of his team, and I always enjoyed him. And he retired, I don't know, I think he was with the Detroit organization for a while now, and it sounds like he indeed did retire from baseball. And this is the second former Twin I have heard where there came a moment where it was almost like they stepped away from baseball with coronavirus and realized, oh, there's a lot in life here that I'm not necessarily experiencing like I wish I was. And it's what's interesting. So the first one was Brian Dozier, former Twins second baseman, great second baseman. And he left. Eventually, I think he ended up, I can't remember all those teams he played for, but I think he eventually ended up with the Nationals. And he retired, and he said, I heard him on MLB Network 2 months ago. He just sort of said, I'm a baseball player. I all of a sudden went home, and I spent time with my kids when I generally do not have any time with my kids. And I realized, this was more important than playing baseball. And it's an interesting argument because, and I got to give him credit because I think there's a lot of people that play baseball that do professional sports that can't have that kind of epiphany. And it was interesting to hear. Gardenhire himself, I mean, he obviously trying to manage through all this crisis. He ended up apparently had food poisoning at some point last year. It was really serious. He was talking about that. And, it was really kind of interesting to hear him just sort of say, I got priorities in life. His exact term was, I don't want to die in the dugout. And I thought put it in perspective. I mean, I love baseball, but put it in perspective. And, whether it's Dozier going back and playing with his kids and realizing, maybe I've been missing out, kind of a la like The Natural, the end of the movie The Natural, or, Gardenhire just sort of saying, how long am I going to hold on to this? I've already proven enough. I don't need to do anything else. And he doesn't. He really doesn't. I think it was great. That's one of the reasons I like, I like baseball. I love baseball. I hope they don't lose. That'd make me mad. Anyway, Twins opener. It's probably going to get a little wet out there, too. Well, like I said, we'll talk to Sven about those things. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. The testimony, we're going to get this hour into the Chauvin trial, and I got to tell you, today, it becomes very difficult for after today, it's going to be very, very difficult, I think, for the defense to really keep pushing the idea that George Floyd didn't die because of Derek Chauvin's knee to the back of his neck, but rather because of a drug overdose. because the two experts today, the first two experts today, they got another guy on the stand as we speak right now. The two experts today, they basically, the first one, Dr. Tobin, you know, he basically, he breaks down exactly physiologically what happens to George Floyd and says, no, he was, this was a lack of oxygen, not because of drugs, but because of the way that where he was on the ground, arms behind his back, the fact that they were lifting up one of his arms, and of course, obviously, Derek Chauvin's knee to the back of his neck. It's very clear what they're putting forward there. Martin Tobin, a physician of pulmonary critical care medicine for Hines Hospital in Chicago. He is really an expert in his field. You can't deny that. He basically studies pulmonology. Pulmonology, the study of lungs and all diseases that affect the respiratory system, describes the anatomy of the pulmonary system as faster than you can take it down. He was clearly an expert. Critical care is where you take the very sickest people, said Dr. Tobin, T-O-B-I-N. He goes through his background. He's from Ireland initially. He practiced across the country, but now he's basically practicing in Illinois, and he came on up here. Asked to share his opinion on the cause. And once again, I'm going to go through this. Today was Jack Rice. I talked to Jack before I came on the air, and Jack feels as if part of what's going on today is that when you get to the medical examiner for the state of for the city, who basically kind of left it up in the air that maybe he died of being kneeled on for 9.5 minutes. Maybe it was something else. Jack brought up the point. He said this could possibly be about painting this guy into a corner to where him as a, you know, a county, you know, doing a county coroner, doing an autopsy on a victim, that you're going to have to go up against some of the brightest minds here and say how your argument is there. And to tell the truth, the first two guys that testified today, it really becomes very difficult. And you could see the defense, the Chauvin's defensive team, they seem to really not be happy about what happened today. The first, and once again, this Tobin, Dr. Tobin, he testified for 3 hours just for the prosecution. I mean, and he brought the science. I mean, he did. I mean, it is some tough things to look at, but he brings the science of what happened to George Floyd and why he died, not because of any drugs. He died not because of the bystanders there. He died because he got suffocated by three police officers who were sitting on top of him, including Derek Chauvin, who had his knee on his neck. So I highly recommend, once again, the two sources I'm going with for the trial, Unicorn Riot, as well as Dina Winter over at the Minnesota Reformer. Asked to share this off the Unicorn Riot feed. Asked to share his opinion on the cause of Floyd's death. Mr. Floyd died from low level of oxygen. This caused damage to his brain. Would also cause PEA, pulseless electrical activity, arrhythmia, that caused his heart to stop. Tobin says he doesn't like the term asphyxia. He says these are other words for a phenomenon that is low level oxygen. Now, once again, this guy is clearly an expert in his field. He's got books out, and people have called him, you know, his books are the best in the industry. So this guy knows what he's talking about. The cause of the low level of oxygen was shallow breathing, small breaths, small tidal volumes, shallow breaths that weren't able to carry the air down his lungs into the essential areas to get the oxygen into the lungs and carry away the carbon dioxide, said Dr. Tobin. The state is about to play a video composed made by Tobin to explain how lungs work. And, you know, there you can buy, by the way, if you go to the Unicorn Riot stream, you can see they have it out all there. There are a number of forces that lead to the size of breath becoming too small. This is Tobin continuing. There is a series of forces leading to that. The main forces leading to the shallow breath are that he's in the prone on the street, has handcuffs in place, combined with the street, as well as a knee to his neck, a knee to his back, and his knee to his side. Dr. Tobin created a 3D model recreating the scene of George Floyd's death, which allows a better view of how Minneapolis PD worked to obstruct his airways on May 25th. And what he does, and this is, I think, a very important element of it, we've all seen the image of George Floyd on the ground with the three police officers with the car there. His graphic removes the car, so you basically see Floyd with the three officers, and you see what they were doing to him. Whether you're making a decision on whether the knee is on the knee or the back, from the point of view of breathing, the effects are very similar. Asked to discuss how handcuffs, prone position, knee to the neck, back, arm and side, how do these mechanisms fall into your work? They don't have a lot to do with clinical medicine, but they're directly related to pulmonary physiology, said Dr. Tobin. The handcuffs are extremely important, but not only on the own. It must be the handcuffs combined with the street and how he's manipulated both by Officer Chauvin and Officer Cooing. They are pushing the handcuffs into his back and pushing them high. And that's something we talked about yesterday, the lifting of the hand, the torturous behavior of Chauvin on George Floyd as he was handcuffed on the ground. He's against the hard asphalt street, and they're pushing him with handcuffs down in the street. Left side is in a vise being pushed in, squeezed in at each side of the bottom. It's not the handcuffs. It's not the handcuffs are being held, pushed, that are totally interfere with the central figures of breathing. Dobin describes how a buckle-handle movement can contract the diaphragm. Tobin is guiding jurors through a pump-handle metaphor of breathing and to take them deep breaths while he describes aspects of how the diaphragm works. Blackwell, who's arguing for the prosecution, for the state, was going to show another exhibit Tobin had prepared, but Nelson objects, asked for a sidebar, and that was not presented. Tobin has selected segments of the involved Minneapolis Police Department officer's body camera videos, which shows the portions where he believes George Floyd was clearly struggling to breathe. Tobin describes seeing that his left hand is being grabbed by the police officers, so that a handcuffed left hand that's being pushed into his chest, so he's not able to expand that. Officer Chauvin's knee is coming in as well, and you're seeing that the size of the chain between the right side and the left side of the cuffs is very short, so his left arm is being pulled over. It's also preventing him from breathing on his right side. So basically, they're pulling the handcuffs on to one side, and it's constricting his breathing on one side as well. Portions of Tobin's testimony feel very familiar to people because if you've ever been arrested before, you kind of know what it feels like to have handcuffs on. I won't say anything more about my own personal experience, but I will agree with that. Tobin says it's extraordinarily significant that George Floyd can be seen pressing his knuckles into the MPD squad car tire as he's being crushed into the pavement. Tobin describes the fast medical terms we don't that basically they're hard to catch. Layperson would see it. He shows that Floyd was actually trying to breathe with his fingers to crank up the right side of his chest. This is the only way to try to get air into the lung. Tobin selected images showing the physiology of how George Floyd was trying to breathe through his shoulder, says it's not an effective way to breathe, but it's why people do what they do when they have to call in the shoulder to try to be able to breathe. So basically, you see his what would be Floyd's right shoulder. He's trying to work the shoulder. I mean, so everything else is getting shut down on him. His shoulder muscle is trying to activate his lung. That's kind of what's going on, for lack of a better way to say it. Someone says the knee and the neck is significant because it occludes, it blocks the airflow of the passageway. Tobin is walking the jury through feeling the anatomy of their necks to understand why the psychology, physiology involved in this testimony. The hippothorax is important to understanding this case because it's very vulnerable, very small. It's basically where what gets crushed in there. He goes through that and explains it as well. On the first slide, you see Mr. Floyd's nose, his face is directly down on the street. It's not at an angle. Nelson then interrupted and said, basically I got upset because he said he didn't like the fact that the expert was kind of working the jury through feeling their neck so they could kind of understand what he was saying. So the judge basically said, you're more than welcome to do what he's saying, or if you don't want to, you don't have to. Tobin says the image on the right, visible how Chauvin has increased the pressure, leading to more severe compression of the hypothorax, compares trying to breathe like that to breathing through a drinking straw, except it's way worse than that. Tobin describes how it's possible to calculate the degree of force Chauvin is pressing into Floyd based on the weight of boots, etc. Tobin is walking through the quote through a graph explaining the effort required to breathe. So basically what he does is he's breaking down the science of breathing. What you're doing, especially in this case with George Floyd, what is his body doing? And he's also then comparing it to what the officers are doing to it and how what the officers were doing was contradicting the breathing ability of George Floyd, that this was not drugs. This was the police officers killed him. Tobin presents he put a physics problem up there that talked about the informs the scientific understanding of the effort to require breath. At some point, and this was very damning. This was very damning. He brings up a photo. What you're seeing is the orientation of Officer Chauvin. His body build is quite erect there, but what you're seeing is that his toe is not touching the ground. That means his entire body weight is directed down on Mr. Floyd's neck, and he shows it. And if you haven't seen it, I wouldn't have looked for that. But indeed, he has Chauvin's feet are off the ground. He literally is balanced on his knee on George Floyd's neck. I mean, that's half his body weight is coming down directly on Mr. Floyd's neck. His toe is off the ground. There's no body weight sitting back, hunkering back. So all that weight is being directed down on the knee. We know that his oxygen levels were enough to keep his brain alive. And the reasons we know that is he continued to speak. He made various vocal sounds for 4 minutes and 51 seconds of the time the knee was on his neck. You can speak without a brain being active. Another sidebar. Judge Cahill asked for if a good time for a morning break. Blackwell says now would be a good time. Court was in recess. Tobin says that when he suffered a brain injury, we can tell from the movement in his leg that he had kicked out his leg in an extension form. That is something we see as clinicians in patients when they suffer brain damage from low-level oxygen. For the first 5 minutes, the left knee on the neck virtually all the time. By my calculation, the right knee is on his neck 57% of the time. I say that because the cameras were moving around. I couldn't see everything that happened. Blackwell enters Exhibit 129, an illustration of the lung function and tidal wave. He goes through more of the science of it there. He calculates, and he goes through as well, the calculations of the amount of oxygen that George Floyd was actually getting in his lungs. EELV or end expiratory lung volume is where your oxygen levels are stored. The volume that's in your lung between each breath, in between your in and out, what remaining of your lung is your EELV. Dr. Tobin calculated the reduction in George Floyd's EELV on May 25th due to prone lung position. It's smaller when you're face down. Your lungs are going to get smaller. You're going to have a greater difficulty. You lay down your belly and going on your chest. Lung volume will go down by 24% simply by turning them prone. The oxygen stores go down to 24% as well. Once you have less volume in your lungs, your oxygen levels are going to go down proportionally. Blackwell asked if someone suffering from COVID might be treated with the prone position. Trovin says, any patients with pneumonia, particularly COVID, you can turn them over. If you flip those patients prone, some of them will show no improvement, but some will get better. Tobin tells Blackwell that it's fine for people who sleep face down because oxygen reserves in the lungs, but when you're going against the street, it asked if it matters was the knee was on Floyd's back, neck, or side. Tobin says the effect is the same. It's going to impair your ability to move your chest. You need to be able to have in mind this is happening on the street, which is totally preventing anything coming from the front. So basically, as opposed to lying in a bed where there's some give on a mattress, he's lying on what at that point was Chicago Avenue. And that's not giving any, you know, so he's basically being crushed by the police officers into the ground. We'll take a break. I mean, and once again, I want to make sure I say something here really quick. This is hard to hear. This is murder. And it is. They murdered him. This is hard to hear. I get it. And I'm sorry. But I mean, for goodness sakes, after today, if you don't convict him all the way across the board, I just don't know what's going on. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, going through the Chauvin trial off of Unicorn Riot's Twitter feed today. This was another one of those oh my moments. When this expert just basically laid it out there, what you're seeing is that there is not just prone. You also have the knee to the neck and back. This is going to squash down the EELV. So the remaining, you know, air that's in the lungs in between breaths. You're seeing a 43% reduction, which also means a huge reduction in the hypothorax. An additional effect is your work of breathing goes up with each breath as he has to try to fight back against the street. He has to try to lift the officer's knee off his neck back. He also has the other officer twisting his arm up to another severe restricting factor. You're looking at more than a threefold increase in the work of breathing, and that's leaving out the knee on the neck just trying to cope with what's happening below the neck. So, I mean, these officers did everything wrong. I mean, everything they possibly could do wrong, they did wrong. He goes through a lot more slides, and he once again, he brought the science to this. Tobin describes being able to tell if a patient is conscious or unconscious by inspecting via a look at their eyes and their face. We know that the moment people lose consciousness, the level of oxygen in their blood will be 36. Very hard scientific data telling us that. And in a 46-year-old man, you'd expect a normal level to be about 49. The moment in which you have lost consciousness is 36. So the minute that George Floyd loses consciousness, his oxygen has the oxygen in his blood has dipped below 36. We're looking at the effect of Mr. Floyd's oxygen levels and the various maneuvers you're going to be done on him when you calculate based on the very vigorous science when the level of oxygen goes to zero. Once he stopped breathing at 20, 25, 16, it would take another 25 seconds for the TBE oxygen level to go down to zero. At that point, there wouldn't be an ounce of oxygen left in the body. So from the minute he died, and I believe Chauvin was on him for another 3+ minutes. 25 seconds later, there was absolutely zero oxygen in his body. We are seeing the level of oxygen gone down to zero. At that point, there was not an oxygen left in the body. That's on very precise science. The knee remained in the neck for another 3 minutes and 2 seconds. After we reach the point where there's not an ounce of oxygen left in the body, Tobin is asked about studies that claim to show neck-on-back maneuvers to be safe. Apparently there's some study they did out in San Diego. He was prepared for that. He absolutely dismantled that argument that knees to the back are a safe idea. Because clearly the people that did this were doing it in a controlled environment, not on a hard surface, but on a mat. And not with a knee, but with weights. So there, and it was all for a specific period of time. So it's not applicable. I mean, clearly, I think Jack is right. I think part of this is to try to knock down the defense's witnesses because they might come on and say this is fine. But he basically said, no, the study that said it's okay was for a limited amount of time on a mat with weights, not an individual. It doesn't compare. Asked if you can speak when you breathe is a true statement. Tobin says that if it's a true statement, but it gives you an enormous amount of false security. Certainly you can speak if you are breathing, but it doesn't mean you are breathing 5 seconds later. You cannot blow air out if you don't take air in beforehand. You cannot speak if you don't take breath. So if someone speaks, you know, there's oxygen going into the brain at the time they're speaking. The brain is the most sensitive area needing oxygen. The brain is relatively small. It's only 2% of our body weight, but it takes up 20% of the oxygen we take in. The brain eats up oxygen at 10 times the normal level. It needs a huge level of oxygen. If you stop your flow of oxygen into the brain, you lose consciousness in 8 seconds. If you can speak, you can breathe. Yes, it's technically true, but it's highly misleading. Blackwell continues. They pull up a clip from a body cam footage. Tobin tells the jury he sees a key finding. When you see his leg coming up, you have to keep in mind he's prone. So this leg coming up in backwards, that's what we call clinicians an extension movement of the leg. That is what we see when someone suffers major lack of oxygen. The bottom line is the leg jumps up like that as a result of fatally low level of oxygen going to the brain. Blackwell now asking Tobin about the physical signs of PEA or pulseless electric activity. Tobin describes PEA as where seeing there's electricity in the heart, but there's not resulting in any mechanical force. This is the first time you're seeing that there is major oxygen damage going on within George Floyd. Blackwell just pivoted to asking Tobin to go into some detail about his physiological research into breathing, talked about the importance of monitoring a pace of breathing to know what's going on inside the body. He's done this millions of times, trained students, doctors, and nurses to do it. Blackwell plays a court body cam video of Floyd being held down prone to the ground as Tobin watches him breathing and counts each breath out loud. The pace is extremely significant, Tobin says, because one of the questions in this case is the effect of fentanyl, and if fentanyl is affecting, it's going to show a 49% reduction in the respiratory rate. Instead, it's right at the normal of 22. So here is your first big slam down on the defense's main point, drugs kill George Floyd. He is counting the breaths. He says, you would see a reduction. There is no reduction. It's normal. Henceforth, drugs weren't slowing down his breath at that point. Floyd's respiratory rate was normal just before he lost consciousness, Tobin tells the court. He's reported to have carbon dioxide level in the arterial blood in his emergency room of 89. That's very high level of carbon dioxide. Normal CO2 levels are 35 to 45. Important factor is to know that he made his own spontaneous effort to breathe. After that, you can see he makes no effort. Then we know that after he stayed on the street for another 3 minutes or so, then we know the ambulance, they attempted to make an airway. As you can see on the officer Coing's body cam, you can see his the first time they actually inserted an airway and gave him his first breath. It's a gap of 9 minutes and 50 seconds from when he took his last breath. This can be calculated via carbon dioxide levels. If someone doesn't take a breath, carbon dioxide levels increase at a predictable rate. So basically he's saying you can tell when he stopped breathing by looking at the amount of carbon dioxide in his blood as he died and then being able to backtrack from the point where they tried to incubate him and backwards. So there you go. Asked for his observation in the last minutes of George Floyd's life, Dr. Tobin says, we're observing the change in his facial expression due to the effects of low oxygen. 43% of our patients die, so I'm very familiar with watching people die. You can see the changes in their face. Blackwell is showing the court and asking Tobin to narrate a slowed-down video which shows the change in George Floyd's face as you see it in his eyes that he is conscious and you can see that he isn't. That's the moment you see life go out of his body. Tobin is now rapidly narrating over clips of body camera of officers restraining Floyd. You can see his hip, how he's rocking the right side of his body, trying to breathe. You can see how he is pressing down the street to try to get in air. Keep in mind the left side is non-functional from the way they have manipulated him. The state just ended the direct examination. Cahill invites Nelson across. Nelson asks for a sidebar. They're going to do a. They decided to go to lunch break for that because you'll figure out here that Nelson is somewhat. There comes a point later on today where Nelson makes the point of he seems just to be ill-prepared for this, you know, that he didn't seem to feel. I don't know if he just didn't feel like these experts were going to be so expert-y, but he clearly seemed to be trying to, you know, he goes after the experts at times here. I'll go over that. Let's take another break. We'll come back. We'll go into the cross-examination of Dr. Tobin when we do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Twins opener day. They're up 4-1 now over Seattle. And, of course, my favorite Twins player is getting ready to hit. Ladies and gentlemen, Jorge Polanco. Love Polanco, man. He's a good player. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So now we get back to cross-examination of Dr. Tobin. And quickly, you know, Nelson is kind of trying to establish some sort of there. And Unicorn Ryan used the words, they're in cahoots with the state to try to stop this and try to find some sort of, you know, that basically that this person didn't just volunteer to testify on their own goodwill, that this is some sort of setup. He doesn't buy it. Nelson just gets, and I got to tell you the truth, there are points here where Tobin really takes Nelson to task. You've taken this case and literally boiled it down to a nanosecond. Tobin, I wouldn't say that. No, if you look at my report, you see a whole chronology. I start with the knee on the neck and it ends with the Hennepin County ER. Nelson characterizes Tobin's representations and testimony as presenting facts in a rapid and oversimplified manner. Tobin disagrees. Nelson again tries to get Tobin with a nanosecond comment when asking if pathologists should look beyond a nanosecond. Tobin, in terms of pathologists, they're looking about it at a nanosecond, the nanosecond of death. They're making an inference about the pathological time point. Dang. You conclude Mr. Floyd dies as hypoxic death. He died of low-level oxygen, which caused damage to the brain. Tobin very quickly coming back on him on that. It's an example of many processes simultaneously. Not really. It's one process affecting the others. And the others that are all being affected together, no, it's just really two, the brain and the heart. So basically saying, no, it's just the lack of oxygen. And the two things that are being shut down are the brain and the heart. Nelson asked Tubin if he saw Chauvin kneeling in a particular ligament in the neck. Tubin agrees. Nelson asking him about being photographed with no injury noted, hypopharynx. Nelson, intelligent men and women who graduate college and go into the field of medical school sometimes have trouble with. A patient comes in and says they're having trouble breathing, and a physician will not believe them necessarily. We're talking about speech, not having trouble breathing. They're not the same. Nelson continues to go after Tubin here. Tubin says, if a Minneapolis police officer tells a person, if you can talk, you can breathe, you have a problem with that? Tubin says, yeah, because you can die in 10 seconds. It was stuff like that. It's stuff like that that Nelson just almost like set it up to kind of get, you know, tripped up, maybe sweep the leg. Nelson, your weight measurements assumed equal measurement distribution between the left and right legs. Yes, but we know the weight is often readjusting. Yes, but still, it was his entire weight on the body and most of it on the neck. Nelson, in terms of the prone position, the pushing the stomach into the lungs, the size of the stomach has some bearing on that. Basically, he tries to get him up on technical issues. And he also seems to try to be trying to trip up Tobin in some way. I mean, it clearly was after the first 2.5 hours of Tobin basically dismantling the argument that George Floyd died of anything else outside of these three police officers killing him. That basically he's trying to find any way that he can discredit him. Nelson asked about depressant effects of fentanyl, asked about the different makeups of street and pharmaceutical products. Isn't it true that every time they make a fentanyl dose, it's a different experience? It acts through the nervous system. It's going to act on the medulla oblongata, not some other mechanism, if it's going to affect the respiratory system. Nelson asking Tobin about known properties of methamphetamine, mentions it can be described for ADHD. Nelson asks about the fentanyl in the hospitals, that wooden chest syndrome is. Some patients with fentanyl can get an increase in chest stiffness. That would decrease the performance of the lungs. It would impact the ability of the lungs to expand. Nelson asking about, but he's bringing up bizarre medical issues at this point. Basically, they're asking about the pills in the back of the car. Nelson asks a hypothetical, a partially ingested pills that were determined to contain both fentanyl and methamphetamine were found partially ingested in the back seat of the squad car. If those pills had DNA of the deceased individual on them, meaning they took them, and that those pills would have been in his mouth for about 2018. Is it fair to say to expect a peak fentanyl respiratory depression in 5 minutes? It would depend on how much you took and the effect would be, but at any amount, the effect would peak, and then yes, we're trying to really confuse me, Mr. Nelson. Nelson, talking about George Floyd's kick of the leg, says it's shown in the body camera footage. Told him there's additional information in the hand and the leg was the key. Nelson, wouldn't be reasonable to say that the police officer could interpret that as resistance. State objects to Nelson's last question, but Cahill sustains the objection. The jurors heard it. So basically, he's trying to make the argument that the death throes of George Floyd, that was the justification for the police to stay on him for another 3 minutes. Nelson asking about the gap between paramedic arrival and the first application of air, almost 9 minutes. Tobin says, yeah, drive to the hospital is about 5 minutes. Tobin said he wasn't aware that there was no reason to dispute it. Nelson cross-examined just ended. Blackwell from the Minnesota State prosecution team started his redirect. Just a few questions, clarification's sake. We're asking about science of medicine involving changing by the millisecond. When Mr. Chauvin was on his back and neck of Floyd, did you see him get off him by the millisecond or nanosecond at all? No. Was he there most of the time? Yes. Not constantly changing? No. Tobin says injuries of the hypothorax are not extremely visible after death. Side effects of low oxygen are not always easy to see after the fact. Tobin laughs and says, no, when Floyd if Floyd died from nicotine, he thought that was, that's ludicrous. Nelson asked about it. The answer is no to the more sober tone when also asked if Floyd died from effects associated with methamphetamine or fentanyl. No signs of depressed breathing due to fentanyl, Tobin says. Blackwell's redirect over. Nelson starts again. You testified his carbon dioxide level was 86. Actually, I think it was 92. Nelson, generally speaking, fentanyl could also cause death from low oxygen. It would have to go through an audible... Yes, but only in part, redirect from Blackwell. Here is another major one. Don't people go into a coma before they die due to fentanyl? Yes. Is there any evidence of coma in this case? No. Fentanyl's gone. Not only do you have the breathing expert looking at this and saying, he clearly was breathing not under the influence of fentanyl, But now you have this little gem that was dropped in here. That how could he have died of fentanyl? Because if you die of fentanyl, you go into a coma, and he didn't go into a coma. The next person in is Daniel Eisenschmidt, a forensic toxicologist at MMS Labs in Horsham, Pennsylvania, since 2011, is chief toxicologist for Wayne County Medical Examiner. It was Maryland Medical Labs. Prompted by prosecution, Eisenschmidt goes over more of the extensive details of his career. You know, they basically just establish this, you know, as, you know, are you qualified to do this? He gets to the methamphetamine. Dr. Eisenschmidt says the methamphetamine levels in the blood sample would be consistent with a low level of daily dose of prescribed use of methamphetamine. So basically, the amount of meth in his system was basically no more than if he was prescribed it by a doctor. Doctor asked to describe fentanyl. He says it's a powerful opiate. All opiates are opiates, not opiates are opiates. It compares it to morphine. Dr. Eisenschmidt is asked to describe the effects of tolerance. Says someone gets used to a drug, you need more and more to get a desired effect. It would get weaker effect after further use. Eisenschmidt asked about non-fentanyl, other issues here. Eisenschmidt says urine samples were positive for cannabis, meth, and fentanyl, opiates. This level can be indicative of blood use prior to the time of death. It shows up in urine longer than in blood. Eisenschmidt says about finding caffeine, the chemical that is metabolite of nicotine, THC, at 2.9 nanograms per milliliter as well. And they go on to talk about, you know, marijuana, cannabis, if that was a problem. They said no. They ask about the presence of methamphetamine and amphetamine as well as Suboxone, getting the finer details of that. Postmodern redistribution can make drug levels show higher in blood than it was present at the time of death. Eisenman asked about data MMS has drawn from many methamphetamine and fentanyl cases. Judge asked if any objection for demonstrative purposes, meaning jury won't take into deliberations, doesn't seem to be any. And he basically goes through and he starts talking about the amount there of fentanyl concentration distribution in the cases. They then get into George Floyd. George Floyd's fentanyl levels were under the median level for blood samples tested by NMS labs were associated with DUIs. So, he did not have enough fentanyl in his system to be even convicted of a DUI, if that was the case. Same report thing happening for methamphetamine. So, once again, you know, low levels of the meth and fentanyl stuff. So, basically, what this expert is saying is, he didn't die of these drugs because the amount that was in his system was equal to a prescription length, you know, dosage, and wouldn't have even gotten him a DUI if he was tested for it because it falls under the amount in his blood, you know, in the blood amount. Direct Nelson begins cross-examination. Nelson asks Eisenschmidt if he's aware of the significant case. He says yes, asks about the accreditation of laboratories. One of those accreditation standards is if substance is below the threshold, you are told not to report it. It's not common practice to report chemical components below the threshold because it's contrary to accreditation standards. Basically, he's trying to trick him up. He asked about various dates Eisenschmidt met with prosecutors. This is, like I said, I think Nelson was just not prepared for such a comprehensive takedown of their main argument. That he didn't die of the Derek Chauvin putting him on the ground, putting him in handcuffs, lifting his arm up and driving his knee to the back of the neck, that he died of drugs, and that this is just as damning. There wasn't enough drugs in his system to kill him. You really are going to have to I agree totally with Jack Rice. I think Jack is right. They are setting up the medical examiner to saying, you better have your facts, because if you're going to go against these people, we're going to throw all their data at you and make you admit they were right. And I think that's what's scaring Nelson right now. Let's take a final break right now for this hour. Come on back. I'll wrap up the hour. They got one more witness on the stand, I think. I don't know if they're still testifying right now. We'll get to that. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, Eisenschmidt, Eisenschmidt is the doctor that's on the stand. He's an expert in drugs. He did a pathological update on the blood samples and urine samples from George Floyd. And I want to repeat what happened. The first, the doctor Toobin, the first expert said, no, he didn't die of drugs. He died because he was being crushed into the pavement of Chicago Avenue by the three officers, primarily by Officer Chauvin, and that he goes through there. And he also points out that he couldn't have died of fentanyl because if you die of fentanyl, you go into a coma, and he clearly did not go into a coma. This doctor is saying, sure, there are drugs in the system, but they're nothing more than prescription level. And the drugs that when they did the tests on him, they determined the drug levels were basically below that of a DUI. So, I think you're going to get in trouble for taking meth or Suboxone or whatever the case may be, period. But, I mean, you know, it wouldn't have been enough to get you a DUI conviction. He says, what was it? Nelson, if the single incident could cause adverse reaction, he says, if you suddenly had a pill that was 10 times stronger than the other, yes. Nelson says, it's been leading me because of fatal overdose cases. It says, if it says that, that's something I corrected that the other day. That's not correct. Nelson starts to ask another cue when Eldridge from the state asks for a sidebar. Nelson is complaining about receiving an updated copy of the presentation, apparently updated 17 pages later. That was last night. He basically wasn't reading. He's saying he didn't know this was coming. Nelson then says he's shuffling papers and stuff like that. Kale says the state asked the state about the dates when the state sent stuff. They did. Nelson then complains about the PDF format. Kale says, if this is in good faith passing of the night in a different version, says no one's at fault, then Nelson seems to have just discovered he had the proper new copy the whole time and he just mixed up. Nelson just doesn't seem like he's ready for this case. Court resumes. Nelson back and cross of the forensic lab toxicologist, Dr. Eisenschmidt. Nelson asking Eisenschmidt about the high number of cases processed by the lab. Nelson trolling for implications of basic questions about DUI, drug levels, blood sample analysis presented early in the court. All we know is that they are deceased. Eisenschmidt, when asked about Nelson, what factual determinations about cause of death can be reached with blood samples alone. Eisenschmidt says he can't speak to concentrations of regional street doses as he heard of phrases like goofballs or speedballs, but he said he'd heard of speedballs. Nelson's verbally trolling of things they may want to suggest to the jury has now proceeded in the area of methamphetamine statistics. Nelson Cross just finished. Eldridge from the state redirect now. Eldridge asked about questions the doctors. Eisenschmidt was asked about MNS testing, whether they were followed the proper certified procedures. He says, yes, they did. They kept the data that they didn't use in the actual report. He says, yes, we keep all data. It's all important. That Floyd's methamphetamine levels were lower than 94% of the DUI population. Cahill keeps sustaining Nelson's repeated objections to similar questions, the fentanyl, norfentanyl, right? Because basically he doesn't want a jury to hear that, no, it wasn't the drugs. Without objection, Eldridge is able to get Dyson Eisenman to answer the affirmative that George's fentanyl levels were lower than the fatal data group levels and within DUI survival average levels. Nelson, how can you answer that question without actually knowing how those people died? Eisenschmidt, no, but I mean, we look at the data very closely. Eisenschmidt is gone. Next witness is Dr. Bill Smock. He's an emergency physician specializing in forensic medicine, legal medicine practiced by legal patients and applying to the legal situations. He worked in emergency level trauma for a trauma center. He's edited numerous textbooks and stuff like that. So he's quite knowledgeable on that level. And forgive me, I'm kind of going through this part. This has all been going on since we've been on the air. Asked about previous work with Louisville Metro Police Department. He asked what kind of police training he does. Smock says he does 4 hours of training with each recruit class, 2 hours in forensic evaluation, gunshot wounds, 2 hours of strangulation. He's asked by Blackwell to describe the administration effects of Narcan, which inhibits the effects of opiate drugs. He says, administer Narcan hundreds of times. That's seeming to end where Unicorn Riot's coverage is today. But that was 48 minutes ago. Needless to say, you can kind of get the idea where the government is going here with this case is that it's, we're not going to allow you to make these arguments because these arguments are garbage. The and forgive me, I'm, you know, as I'm scrolling through here, as I see this, asked if he thinks George Floyd was showing dying of asphyxia. Smock said he thinks it's the next video portion where you can see his facial expression, sounds of him getting closer. He loses consciousness, describes the physical seizure symptoms of a fatal oxygen loss. Smock, his left shoulder was bruised from being pushed into the pavement. His face was bruised from being pushed into the pavement. Asked about timing of CPR, Smock says the sooner we start, the higher the chance of success is. Soon as Floyd was unconscious, he should have been rolled over. We have an officer in the video saying we can't find a pulse. When you can't find a pulse, CPR should start ASAP. States direct done with Smock. Nelson coming to cross elicits his agreement that the fact that this is a pathologist, he's trained in forensic pathology. Nelson asks if he subscribes to the Journal of Forensic Medicine. You know, Nelson's scrambling here. Asked if there's no safe level of methamphetamine, Smock says no. Well, there is a safe level of amphetamine for people with ADD. Asked if Nelson about likelihood of death and fentanyl, Smock says it depends on how much fentanyl was taken as soon as medical aid is rendered. Lots of factors. Nelson says the chance to make the point of repeating lots of factors before his next question. Nelson asks Smock if he knows about partially ingested pills. Basically, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to frantically save his case. His case right now is going down the toilet because he's basically banking everything on it was a drug overdose, and it clearly wasn't. The experts weighed in today. Hour two of the show, that's coming up next. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Basically, I'm kind of paying attention as this is going on right now. The defense team is basically trying to salvage any element of their drug overdose argument they can. They're basically, you know, the whole thing is, is any level of this bad? Yes. Well, we just already had two people say, no, he didn't have enough in his system to cause this. And it's clear he didn't die of fentanyl because he wasn't in a coma. So, you know, and the expert, the breathing expert shows, no, that he didn't die of fentanyl because he counted his breath. He said, if it was fentanyl, there'd be a different breathing pattern. He was basically killed by the four officers. So, that gives you an update. I'll go through this at the end of this hour here. We've got Sven Sundgaard coming up here. We'll talk about weather. Also his second shot here in the case he's going through right now, how it's affecting him. Because I know sometimes the second shots on the vaccine can have varying details here. But we've got some good news, Patrick. Good news indeed. We got another one. FBI agents in Rochester have arrested a woman early on Thursday on charges connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. You traitorous bastard, you traitorous. Well, I'm sorry. Victoria White, 39 years old, will make her first appearance in federal court today. The details of the charges are currently under seal. Lartvita McFarquhar, a friend of Light, said White called her this morning around 6:20. He said, "The FBI's around my home." I'm going to guess it was like that. McFarquhar read the allegations listed in the warrant, which White sent to her, to the Star Tribune, knowingly remaining in restricted building on grounds without lawful authority, disorderly and disruptive conduct to the restricted building and grounds, violent entry and disorderly conduct to Capitol grounds, parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building, impeding or attempting to impede law enforcement officers performing official duties, obstruction of justice. Once again, not Black Lives Matter, not Antifa, Trump fans. In the interview, McFarquhar, now this is the friend of Victoria White, who is, you might know her name. She ran that Haven's Garden Cafe in Lynn, where she basically refused to close the restaurant, defying Governor Walz's pandemic lockdown restrictions. So she's already kind of out in Looneyville. In the interview, McFarquhar, she said that White attended the Donald Trump rally in Washington, D.C. on January 6th and the protests of the U.S. Capitol. We were there to peacefully protest, and that was it. McFarquhar says she never stepped in foot in the Capitol building. White did, though, enter for the Capitol. You're just not, it wasn't, you, if you went into the, never mind. Inadvertently, she stepped into a staircase, was pulled through the gate. I didn't see too many people getting yanked through there. So a lot of people walking in on their own. Never once did I or any that I was with, especially Victoria, do anything illegal. Well, funny story, you should ask. If she entered the Capitol building and she was there and she was photographed there, well, yeah, she did. Because as much as you guys like to say, this is the people's house. No, it's not. You can't just go into the White House. try. I mean, you're more than welcome to try. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch the hog pile of Secret Service agents on top of you. It will be a delight. But you're more than welcome to. We do have, I mean, you have a business. If someone kicked open the door of your business this morning, or if let's just say you accidentally left the door unlocked and you walked in there and there were some people there before your business opened, would you just say, well, I guess they're here legally because the door was unlocked? No, you'd call the police and say you got people trespassing. Even if they didn't do anything, they'd still be trespassing. That is a breaking of the law. You have your own business. This is clearly what was going on. Never once did I or anything that I was with, especially Victoria, do anything illegal. She says what they're doing right now is a farce and it's disgusting. No, it's called charging traitors. And she's going to jail. She's going to jail. McFarquhar owns that restaurant. A lot of Republicans like to pose with at that restaurant. Love that. I'm sure they're going to be out there any second now that they're someone who is associated with that restaurant is now being charged with treason. Or treasonous, with a treasonous event, I should say. Oh, that's, I'm going to guess, what, 5 years in jail? She's going to go to jail for 5 years? At the least. During the January 6th pro-Trump demonstrations, many of the former president's supporters stormed the joint congressional session formalizing the electric victory of Joe Biden, falsely claiming Biden stole the election. Members of the group severely damaged the nation's Capitol building, sending members of the Congress into lockdown, killing a Capitol police officer, and leaving about 138 officers injured. White is the second Minnesota to be charged in relation to the attack. Last month, federal prosecutors charged Jordan Stotts, a 31-year-old from Moorhead, with trespassing and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. Both federal misdemeanors. Got to catch them all. It's like Pokemon, only they're traitors to America. Got to catch them all. Lock her up. Lock her up. Oh, isn't it just, don't you just love being able to turn that back around on him? Lock her up. Lock her up. Lock her up. I'm sorry. We talked about this a little bit with Stein yesterday. The Republican Party is bleeding supporters. People actually are unregistering as Republican because of what happened on January 6th. And that is why there is this now national attempt to say, okay, so a bunch of rapscallions got into the Capitol building. What they completely are trying to eliminate the fact that a police officer was killed, 138 were injured, that you had them screaming, hang Mike Pence. You had people in both the House and Senate chamber going through documents trying to find dirt. You had someone on a radio when they found out that the Congress was basically in a secure location wanting to gas them. You had people walk around with hog ties looking to take hostages. You had people who were basically looking for any way in the world to basically create a situation where they could take hostages. No, this wasn't harmless fun. And how many of you smeared your feces all over the Capitol? Seriously, how many of you smeared your feces all over? We were just being respectful. You all need to go to jail. You all need to go to jail. You're traitors to America. And I refuse to allow this narrative to get changed. There is an insane amount of money that gets poured into news cycles in this country to try to drive a conservative narrative. And the reality is, as we talked about this yesterday as well as Stein, that Republican, the number of people who are Republican, only 25% of this country are Republican. Only 25%. 30% are Democrat. So far more people are Democrat than Republican. And when you factor in independents who lean one way or the other, Republicans only get to 40%, Democrats at 49%. Far more people in this country believe in Democratic principles. So why is it that the news cycles are so just chock full of conservative-based stories? We talk about George Floyd. From the minute that happened last May, most people felt as if Derek Chauvin should go to jail. In the almost year since, they have had an absolute campaign to change the narrative on this to where, and I got to tell you, once a day I get some loser Twitter guy with 3 followers saying, it was the drugs that killed him, not Derek Chauvin. And that's their whole argument, is that this is drugs. And where do they get this from? It's that narrative. And it runs from the fringe extreme, the QAnon, the online, the 8chan world. But it runs all the way up to even news outlets who are, you would consider yourself, oh, they're fairly straightforward. No. There is a concerted effort to get a concerted effort to get a conservative narrative pushed forward, and it works, it succeeds, and this is why I'm so incensed by any idea, any notion, any attempt to take what happened on January 6th and turn it into some sort of harmless get together cookout barbecue. Sure, there were some people on the other side of the Capitol, but we just went in there, we grabbed hands, we sang kumbaya. We just wanted to have an honest discussion with the politicians. You broke into the Capitol building. Didn't you guys see smashing windows? I have yet to see any picture of people as this woman, Victoria White, is claiming she was, I should be fair, McFarquhar, White did enter part of Capitol, she said, but inadvertently when she stepped into a staircase was pulled through the gate. I haven't yet to see any footage of anyone getting pulled into a building. And trust me right now, if Victoria White got pulled into this building and immediately said, whoa, I don't want to be in here. We're not supposed to be in here. I'm going to leave. The federal authorities would not be charging her with a crime. Because there apparently were some people like that who realized, oh, we shouldn't be here, and they got out of there. And so far, to my knowledge, a lot of those people have not been charged. It's the most egregious people that were in there. Those are the people that were charged. And I guarantee you, we're going to find out in this case what exactly this woman did, because they got video footage of it. And once again, it's not just the cameras that were in the Capitol building. All you morons posted your crime on Parler, and we have it all. We have it all. So if Mrs. McFarquhar, Ms. McFarquhar, if she is correct, if there is nothing here, well, this will be an easy case to win. But my guess is going to be is that this isn't going to be an easy case to win, and this is just big government out of control. No. The people that were out of control, the people that stormed the Capitol. And the sooner you fools realize that Donald Trump, the guy who basically screwed you over on campaign donations, who set up a fraudulent system to take mandatory deductions out of people's bank accounts and credit cards, that was the default setting. You didn't have to sign up for that. That was the default setting. To unsign up for that, you had to read through the entire list in terms and check one small box at the end of it. It was really deceptive. He clearly does not care about you fools. But here you are, you're willing to fight to the end. Ms. White, I hope you go to jail for a long time. I do. I hope you get to sit in a federal penitentiary for 4 or 5 years and get to think long and hard about whose fault this really was. Because the reality is, you can't just storm into any building and scream, the people's house. You can't do that. And I guarantee you, if someone had done that while Trump was in the White House, you'd be like, get that psychopath and arrest them and charge them with trespassing. You guys were not anything but traitors to America. Traitors to America. Arrest the insurgents. You are no better than, in my mind, the people that attacked the Capitol are no better than the people that attacked us on 9/11. They're no better than the Nazis. They're no better than Confederacy. They are traitors to the American flag. And the only flag that they care about is the one that says Trump on it. And they try to install a dictator in this country and came shockingly close to being able to pull that off. And I will never forgive you. So burn in hell, Victoria White. Burn in hell. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I hope they charge you with everything. Good luck. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Minnesota Coronavirus Update when we do return. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Seriously, I have zero. As a disabled veteran of the U.S. Army, I have zero tolerance for these insurrectionists. I have zero tolerance for this attempt to take over this country. I have zero. Every one of them, lock them up. Lock them up. Give them as harsh a sentence as you can. Seriously, get rid of them all. And like I said, you guys posted all the evidence against you online, so... You better, if this is the case, I mean, hey, maybe Victoria White does have evidence she was dragged in there and she was fighting the entire time to get back out. I highly doubt the feds would be charging her if that's the case, but maybe they do. But I guarantee you, any video of her in that will be in the Capitol will be presented in a trial that she'll have to answer for. So we'll have to see. Minnesota surpassed 3 million COVID-19 vaccine doses administered in a race against the pandemic that has caused 6,922 deaths, 535,182 diagnosed infections in the state. The vaccination milestone comes amid a new wave of COVID-19 activity in Minnesota, which reported 14 more deaths, 2,535 infections. That's way too many. On Thursday, a 6.4 positivity rate, percent positivity rate. Now, a reminder, we are at 3.5. I believe in early March. So in 1 month, we have gotten this has gotten out of control. It's spring breakers, it's kids' sports, and it's schools. I mean, that's what's causing this, because this UK variant is it basically is traveling from, you know, it goes right through the kids. I mean, they're actually getting sick off this now. The number of COVID-19 cases admitted to Minnesota hospital beds increased again from a low of 210 on March 6 to 565 on Wednesday. I want to repeat that number because, dear Lord, in 1 month, we went from 210 people in hospitals to 565 on Wednesday. The latest total includes 131 people in intensive care beds due to respiratory problems, other complications. Governor Walz on Wednesday promoted continued vaccination as a key to overcome the pandemic in Minnesota, where shots have been administered to 43% of all eligible people, 16 and older, and 83% of all senior citizens. 83%, that is amazing. Considering, I would guess 15% of all senior citizens are like these never-Trumpers who have vowed they'll never get a vaccine. You know, you're getting pretty much everyone else at this point vaccinated. The total of 1,900,248 people have received vaccine in Minnesota includes 1,247,045 people who have completed the one or two dose series. That is got to be, it's over. What's population? Time for Matt's Math Corner. I got to do something here. Population of the state is basically 5.6 million. 5,600,000. All right. So if you have, let me do it the other way here. 1, 2, 4, 7, 0, 0, 0. All right. 1, 2, 4, 7, 0, 0, 0. Divided by, that would be divided by, I believe, 5, 6, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 equals, well, we're 22% of the state. 22% of the state's been vaccinated fully. We got to get that number up faster. Well, I mean, we're going as fast as we can. For goodness sakes, you can't find an appointment to get a vaccine at this point. This is our fastest million doses yet, said Governor Walz on Thursday, noting Minnesota reached 2 million doses administered in 3 weeks ago. So in 3 weeks, we've gotten another million doses administered. With fans of the stands at Target Field, the signs are all around us. Spring has arrived. Normalcy is near. I don't say the normalcy is near until this is kind of done. Deaths have not increased in the latest pandemic wave in Minnesota, and that gives us hopes the vaccination efforts have protected the most vulnerable from severe COVID-19 illnesses. If that pattern holds, Walz said Minnesota could see further reductions in business and social restrictions. Walz called vaccine a tool we do not have in our toolbox last year. 12 of the 14 deaths reported on Thursday involved senior citizens who have suffered 89% of the COVID deaths in Minnesota. 8 involved people who lived in private residences. 6 involved residents of long-term care facilities. More infectious variants are fueling renewed pandemic. Last week's COVID-19 report released Thursday by the Minnesota Department of Health continued increases through March 27th of infections on college campuses and among K-12 students. It's you got parents who are taking kids on planes. I mean, it really is. It's a perfect storm of stupidity. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's a perfect storm of stupidity. You have parents who are like, I got my party. And so they are jumping on a plane and taking their kids, and they're going down and going to some place for a vacation, going to Florida, maybe going to Mexico. And like this nurse story from earlier this week, I mean, you get in an airplane, you're in a small, confined plane with circulated air. I understand she got vaccinated, but I also understand you basically are in a small, confined place with circulated air for hours. 4 hours. Now, this is just, it's stupidity. And the kids come back, and they're going through school, and they're taking off their masks, and let me tell you about my spring vacation. And then I got to go to sports, and that's how it's happening. And it really is. This version of the coronavirus is affecting the kids far more. And it's not making them sick, but everyone in the state should be incredibly concerned. Where there we were talking about this as well, that there is now pretty much studies that are occurring that are saying to us that there indeed are a lot of long-term effects of coronavirus. Now, I want you to think about your 14, 15, 16-year-old kid. How would you like it? Because you had to go on a vacation party, woo, spring break. You had to go do that. Let's say they end up having a lifetime of lung issues because of that. We talked about, apparently there's mental health issues as well. Psychosis, dementia, that is popping up within some of these people. Let's say that you get an insane increase in that. Is that really worth the risk? I have friends. I got a good friend, Jackie. She just mentioned to me yesterday. She's pulling her kids out of school. They're going to go back to virtual because I think it's the best. She thinks it's the best way to go, and I'm not disagreeing with that at this point. I'm absolutely not disagreeing with that. Let's get, before we go, got Sven Sundgaard coming up here in just a few minutes. Julie is in Minneapolis. Let's get her before we get into the break. Hey, Julie.
I just thought I'd jump in quick. I thought it'd be a big tattletale. I don't know if you've covered this because I just jumped in on your show, but I have a friend whose 14-year-old goes to Bloomington Kennedy.
Yep.
And about 3 weeks ago, this supposedly didn't hit the news. The junior class, they all had a party, and they all got COVID.
Oh, wow. This is a Bloomington Kennedy, you said. Bloomington Kennedy.
Yeah, and the symptoms weren't that severe, but they all had to stay home, and it kind of worked out because there was spring break anyway. But anyway, my friend's take on it is that parents didn't want to talk about it, and because they want their kids in school. So I heard Osterholm say like 750 schools in Minnesota. So that's one of them. I don't know. I shouldn't rat somebody out, but that's one of them that was or wasn't counted. Good old Bloomington Kennedy, and the kids are partying.
Well, and for the record, that's Julie ratting you out, not me. I'm on your side. Julie in Minneapolis, thank you very much. I appreciate the phone call. I think that story, by the way, Julie, I think your story there is actually far more common than you say, because I know of another school, I'm not going to say which one it is, similar situation. They wanted to do a senior party, so some of the parents went out there and put together a senior party, and apparently half the kids that were at that senior party have now got COVID. And so going back to the story here, COVID-19 cases rates are highest right now in central Minnesota region around Stearns County, as well as some isolated areas such as Jackson County on the southern border, Couchiching County on the northern border. That's Ely is up in St. Louis County, but I think Couchiching neighbors that. They've had just problems in these communities up there where it is. It's school sports. The kids are going on out. They'll play a hockey game and come back. Half of them will have COVID. And then it wipes out the school. Then it wipes out the community. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard from Bring Me the News. We'll talk weather when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Sven Sundgaard, of course, is the weather man extraordinaire for bringmethenews.com. You can also go to his YouTube channel as well. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about weather and various other things. Hey, Sven, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I want to touch on something non-weather first, though, if we can. Congratulations. I heard you got your second dose of vaccine.
Yeah, second dose of Moderna. I'm fully vaccinated, although they tell you 2 weeks after the date you're considered fully vaccinated, I guess I should say. But there'll be no more shots put in me is what I mean.
Have you had any side effects? I mean, I think it's Moderna is the one that my friends who get that second shot say that's the one that you kind of get some heavy duty. You can get some heavy duty symptoms with. Have you had any problems?
You know, I've heard the same things, but then I've heard like people say that about the Pfizer one. And then I've heard people with the Johnson & Johnson. And so far, so good. So I am about 29 and a half hours in from my second dose yesterday. And, you know, I think I just tweeted and posted on Facebook. I've been kind of live updating because a lot of people are genuinely curious. You know, I heard from a lot of people, I get my second one in a couple weeks, or just even people wanting to compare their own experience that they had. And, you know, I'm a little tired now. I would say I'm more tired right now than I normally would be at 5:30. But I don't know if that's because I'm hyper aware, you know, if it were a normal, basically whatever I'm feeling right now, if it happened on a normal day, I would just consider myself to be having a sort of a low key tired evening. And, you know, my head, I don't have a headache, but my head feels like a way I described to somebody is if you drink too much coffee, which I often do, and all of a sudden you get that kind of rush in your head that says, if you keep going, you're going to have a headache, you know, like sort of that warning, the head's getting a little heavy, but not quite there yet. So all in all, I feel pretty good. I can't complain.
I get my second dose of Pfizer on Tuesday. Over at the VA. And so I'm looking forward to that. But I will say that it's going to be interesting. I'm going to get mine in the morning. I'm hoping I don't have any symptoms, or else I could have a very interesting show that afternoon.
Yeah, you know, who knows? I just purposely made sure that today was going to be pretty quiet, nothing going on. I wasn't going to plan anything. I will say what I do think after my first shot, really, I'm feeling like I did after my first shot. About a day or two after, I felt a little tired at times, but I just figured that makes sense because your body's building antibodies.
Yeah.
But my arm was really sore after the first shot, but I do tend to tense up. So people who haven't gotten their shots yet, or even if you have one more, I guess the best thing, and the nurses will tell you this too, keep that arm relaxed.
Yes.
Like, you know, dangle it. That makes a big difference. And they tell you to keep it moving, and which is good advice, but one way to do that, and I felt good still several hours after my shot yesterday, I went to the gym and I worked out. I didn't do an arm workout, but just doing anything, even if you're speed walking, or I went for a run after too, you're moving your arms. And I think even that helps. My arm is dramatically less sore at the site of injection than it was with the first shot.
My daughter, she worked because of her job. She basically got her first shot. She said the same thing, that her arm really hurt. I mean, I had like a master.
I hate needles. That's my thing.
Is it? I'm not a big fan of them either, but the woman that gave me my first shot, she was brilliant. I mean, she's, you know, she was really good. I didn't even feel it, if you want to know the truth. So, you know, I think it depends too.
Neither were painful. It's just, it's in my head, like needle going into arm. I've got different shows someday. I have a horror story with like blood draws. Those are the worst. So it's that kind of thing. But yeah, I barely felt mine yesterday. It was like a strong mosquito bite. You know, you feel the pressure more than anything.
I've got a friend who lives in Amsterdam who posted a picture on Easter weekend of snow. And she said, this is weird in Amsterdam to have snow in April is an understatement. You had posted on your last weather forecast. I think the one you did yesterday, the weather forecast you did yesterday, you posted that Europe has gone through a roller coaster right now.
Yeah. So that's worth note, the snow that you mentioned, but Amsterdam also, the Netherlands had its earliest record of that kind of heat a couple weeks before that. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? So hopefully we're not headed for that here, but you know, it's kind of indicative of these bizarre swings that we've been seeing. And we've talked about it, I think, a little bit here, but there's ongoing research, you know, as we warm up the Arctic, and the Arctic is warming anywhere from 2 to 4 times faster than the global average, by creating less of a temperature difference between the Arctic and mid-latitudes in the equator, we're weakening jet streams. So they're becoming much more amplified, as in, you know, they look like they're just kind of this tangled up knot versus generally flowing west to east with minor bumps, ups and downs. So you get these big, huge ups and downs in the jet stream. And that just can, if you're on, depending on what side of it you're on, you go from one extreme to the next. And, you know, one of the scenarios where we really saw this play out here was, if you remember back to 2018, we had the coldest April on record. Mm-hmm. We had that big April blizzard. And then May was the fourth hottest on record. We statistically went from March. I mean, it literally was. April was as cold as an average March. And that May was as warm as an average June. So we went from March to June. And we joke about it around here, how we go from winter to summer. But we literally did that year. And this is a similar situation in the pattern playing out in Europe. And hopefully not here. Mm-hmm. I would like to not see, let's find a happy medium.
Well, you and I talked about this. I mean, it's that jet stream that runs up on the northern parts of the Arctic Circle up there. It just seems like it's falling apart at times. And, yep. And you know, all of a sudden we get this large thrush of cold air. And as you said, when we talked about it a few months ago, you said, yeah, when that cold air comes down, the worst effect is that the hot air rushes into that area. And it just yep. seems to be destabilizing more and more.
Absolutely. And that setup is prime for these things that, you know, we heard people been hearing more about now, these polar vortex disruptions, you know, what dislodges the coldest air from the Arctic is when we have these wonky patterns. You know, it's almost certain that the very warm summer that we had in Siberia last year and the extreme loss of sea ice there, and all that extra ocean heat that was absorbed, that's all that heat, all that energy stays there. And what happens to anything that's warmed is it expands and rises. So you have all that extra energy and momentum. It's got to go somewhere. And that knocked the polar vortex off of its kilter pretty early in the winter. It happened right around New Year's. So really only about a month into meteorological winter. So even though Siberia had cooled off by that time and the sea ice had reformed, all that energy, all that mm-hmm. momentum has to go somewhere.
When you're talking on this level, I mean, you know that there's an insane amount of energy that's released there. I mean, you don't see it because people just go out and look at their field and say, well, it looks like a normal day to me. But when you look at it on a global scale, it really is messing up.
Yeah, and that's why it's really important to look at trends and patterns. The few skeptics that are left weren't as vocal this year, I noticed, during our 2 whole weeks of cold weather in February. But I mean, we quickly turned that around with the 8th warmest March, you know, as we've talked about on record, you know, and just a ridiculously warm April so far, which is hard to complain about. I know a lot of people have been commenting on my posts and I'm there with you. You know, I love summer. So 85 degree day, great, but when it's April 5th, that's a problem.
Yes. No, I mean, it's nice, but it's horribly wrong, and that's the deal. By the way, if you need climate change deniers, I'll get you some guys off my Twitter feed, because every time I bring it up, yeah. I get some buttes. You had a graphic.
They'd probably go back and forth between us, honestly. Yeah. You know, there are about a dozen trolls out there, especially on Twitter.
you had a graphic I loved. It was in the sense being it's why we got warm. It was like a highway was built from Arizona straight up to Minnesota, and yeah, it was amazing. You don't generally see it so cleanly like that.
Yeah, we do. You're right. It was just very apparent then. But we do often get we call it high desert air, and you know I tried to very simply explain it by showing weather balloon data, which is much more complicated. I could do a whole 3-4 minute segment just on deciphering that. But basically, you could see the air that was not from here, but from somewhere else much warmer. And it was that dry, warm desert air that gets literally, we call it advection in meteorology, but it just means thrown into, essentially, moving horizontally. And what we know about that area of Western Texas, New Mexico, it's much higher than here. And so where we see it in our upper atmosphere is, you know, at least 3, 4, 5,000 feet above the ground. And then what happens is when we heat up during the day, the sun does its thing and wind does its thing. We mix in with that air a lot. And when you bring down air from aloft, it warms as air sinks, just like you have with a Chinook wind or the Santa Ana winds. The compression heats up air. And so long story short, you know, when you can basically put in 3/4 of a very warm air mass in place, all we got to do is that bottom quarter's worth of work, which the sun can do this time of year, and we get those extreme temperatures. But obviously, even that was extreme for us. It's the earliest we've ever been that warm on record, 85 degrees that early.
It felt like late May. When those storms finally started rolling in, it felt like we were in late May, and that was a weird feeling because it was nice to see the storms because we desperately needed water throughout the state.
Yeah, this is our fire season. We tend to think of California or Australia, and those are extremes where they have months of dry weather normally. For us, it's this, which has already ended, brief period, in late March into April, early May, normally, where before things have greened up, all that dead debris, the fact that the air is so dry because nothing is alive yet, you don't have evapotranspiration, and we don't quite have the regular airflow from the Gulf of Mexico, so those humidity levels are low. And we saw this Monday, 85 degrees, but the humidity was like 15%. And, so you have evaporation going on like crazy that just dries things out even more. And then the wind, of course, and if any fire gets going, it can spread like crazy. And we've seen, I noticed driving to my dad's last weekend in northwestern Wisconsin, a couple different spots that you could see were not scheduled or prescribed burns.
Yeah.
You know, there have been several grass fires around lately. Luckily, like I said, it's kind of a brief season because the other unusual thing, which is, of course, related to the weather, is how green everything is already.
Yes, yes.
And all the buds and leaves out. I mean, this is 3 weeks ahead of schedule, at least.
Yeah, you had...
This is a late April situation that we're at already.
You had Syrup Lady, who was trying to cook syrup down. She started a fire. You had the guy that was trying to burn off a log. And then it was, what was it, the cigarette butt up on...
A cigarette butt, I think.
Lake Elmo, yeah.
That's the one I passed.
Wow.
And you saw how close it got to several structures and the on-ramp or off-ramp from 35. And I'm just like, come on, people, a little common sense.
Well, heaven forbid. What's amazing to me and what concerned me as we watched those storms come in, there were some pretty impressive lightning displays. And obviously, if the rain's not coming in, but lightning is starting to hit, that could have set off some as well. But how much rain have we gotten since it started raining here in the cities?
So far, I haven't added that all up. You're putting me on the spot. I guess I should have anticipated that. I know yesterday we had 68 hundredths of an inch.
Okay.
So far. So now, luckily, I can pull up the data pretty quick. And then another three. So we're almost closing in on an inch of rain. And we've got another probably half inch on the way tomorrow. So we'll end up with, it'll vary, but probably 1 to 2 inches, especially since the beginning of the rain this week was thunderstorm. That doesn't include Monday night's rain, which was more hit and miss. But yesterday, today, rainfall amount so far.
Do you know what tells me that how low our water totals were? I went biking yesterday, and I'm on the trail that goes over Minnehaha Creek over off of Highway 169. And if we had that much rain generally, and we weren't dry, Minnehaha Creek would be over its banks, and it wasn't. It was actually quite, it looked quite normal. And that was when I first looked. I said, "How dry really have we been?" I think, and I went and checked Nine Mile Creek as well. Nine Mile Creek has not breached its banks yet either. I mean, we were really low.
Yeah, I'd have to go look back at the fall, but it does seem, if I can jog my own memory, that we had a dry fall because we went right into that weird cold in October, and that big snow we had in October is helpful because that kind of snow at the beginning and end of the season around here does get absorbed into the ground very quickly. I'll sometimes hear people talk about, oh, all this snow in January is going to be helpful. Well, not really, because a lot of that evaporates in just the nature of our snowfall compared to warmer climates. But I mean, snow is an important component, especially some of the waterways, like you mentioned, lakes and rivers and that, but we also had below normal snowfall this year too. So,
It is concerning because all it will take, and the way this weather's gone the last 10, 15 years, and I can already see this coming. And say all of a sudden May and June it gets really dry again, and we were already behind. All of a sudden, we're back into fire warnings across the state. And, you know, as you say, you got a lot of people out there, whether it's people checking a cigarette butt out or trying to make delicious syrup, you can get, you know, yeah. you can get out of control fairly quickly. And I don't want another year like it was a few years back. We had all those fires, especially up in the north, that were just burning everywhere, it seemed like.
Yeah, you know, and that's the main lesson of climate change, too, is it's the extremes. And in a place like this that is extreme, we see the extremes getting to be more extreme. Because one of the things we are seeing is an increase in extreme rainfall events. You know, those 3-4 inch rainfalls are becoming much more frequent in the summer. But of course, the nature of thunderstorms is that's hit and miss. It depends where you are. And then, you know, but because this is a place that goes through natural, drier and wetter periods too, those are becoming more extreme. So the wetter periods are really wet, but then we're more prone to occasional droughts. But overall, with our warming climate, we're seeing an increase in precipitation. But yeah, we very well could get it stuck into one of these dry patterns that are even drier than they otherwise would be.
I'll give Sven all the credit here. It's because of Sven's forecast. The Twins games got in. They're at leading 7-2, by the way, in the sixth inning.
Good.
There you go.
I haven't kept track of the score. I'm not a huge sports fanatic, but I think like a lot of people, we're really rooting for them today just because it's a sign of some normalcy in summer and everything else.
Absolutely, and it's going to get in today. They're not. You said rain tomorrow. They don't have a game tomorrow because it's because of the opening weekend. They generally skip one day, so they don't have
That's
a game
good.
Tomorrow. But that tomorrow's going to be the rain day. Is it going to clean out after that for the weekend?
It does, but it's going to. If you're looking for a lot of sunshine just yet, you're going to be waiting. But yeah, we're going to be in sort of a break. There have been one or two random showers still over the last couple of hours. I think one did go over Target Field briefly. But I mean, considering that sandwiched in between all this rain, they got pretty lucky. And temperatures, of course, are pretty mild. And then most of tonight will be mainly dry again, one or two of these random showers. The next round of the real persistent rainfall is going to come in late tonight, early tomorrow morning, anywhere between 3 to 6 a.m. And it does look like it's going to rain much of tomorrow, finally wrapping up in the evening. So if you do want to get outside at some point, maybe after 5, 6 o'clock tomorrow, you should have an opportunity. At least it won't be spectacular, but at least hopefully the rain will have stopped by then. And then Saturday looks just cloudy. I don't think we'll see sun yet. Sunday we should see some sun, and then that'll push us back up close to 60, probably just 50s the next couple of days. And then we're in for some cooler weather next week too. Looks like the middle of next week might actually be, brace yourselves, below normal.
Oh my.
For a couple of days. That's something that's been very rare. Yeah. Some of the models have not gotten us out of the 40s Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, which, considering the role we've been on, that will be a shock to the system. But the good thing for me is if we're going to have this early green up, I would hate to see us get into one of these, which can happen in April, of course, hard freezes that just kills everything and has to start over. It doesn't look like that. We'll probably have a couple of frosty mornings, but not those super cold overnights and mornings, luckily, next week. And then we're back into the 60s plus the week after. Normal sort of April correction here.
Okay, cool. I'll get a weather forecast posted from you. And if you're not following Sven on his YouTube page, I'll make sure I get that posted up as well. Sven Sundgaard, bringmethenews.com. You can find his weather forecast there too. Sven, thank you very much. I appreciate it as always.
Yes, you're welcome. Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care. Sven Sundgaard, kind enough to join us. Spotlight that interview. We'll take a break. Come on back. One more story before we wrap up before Native Roots Radio. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Nice to have Sven Sundgaard coming on the air. I like talking to him, especially when it gets to the weather stuff. The guy knows everything there. Follow him on YouTube. He's fantastic over there. One final story to get to today. Minnesota lawmakers have progressed two largely different proposals that changed the state's voting laws. Republicans in the Minnesota Senate advanced legislation Wednesday that has the potential to restrict same-day voting registration, among other changes, on the state's election law. In a 5-3 party line vote, the state Senate Government Finance and Policy Elections Committee approved the massive omnibus bill, sending it to the Senate Financial Committee. Minnesota allows voters to register to vote or re-register if they moved since the last time they voted at their polling place on Election Day and then cast their ballot, which was then counted with all the other ballots. But the Senate proposal, sponsored by one of the sorest losers, Mary Kiffmeyer is just so bitter that she sucked at being Secretary of State, and Steve Simon is so good at it. I mean, really, that's all it is. So Mary Kiffmeyer who loves those junkets. Oh, the Alec people. Oh my God, do they know how to throw a party? Kiffmeyer would change that by requiring an unregistered voter or someone who has a register at a new address to cast only a provisional ballot that would be set aside for a week until election officials verify their eligibility before it's counted. Basically, make sure I'm going to repeat something Tom Hartman has talked about. Provisional ballots are Republican co-word for your vote will not count. That is that they actually will fight to prevent provisional ballots from being counted because they have no intention of counting them. So whenever I hear a Republican, you know, mentioning, oh, we're going to do a provisional ballot, that's basically saying, oh, we'll let you vote in the circular file, that sort of thing. What's more, each of these two proposed provisional ballots would have their authenticity challenged. In the event this happens, the voter would have to show up in person to prove their authorized vote. So you basically have a Republican operatives waiting at every courthouse and saying, I'm going to challenge that ballot. And so the person that's got to show up, and they got to show up in 20 minutes. And if they don't, it's invalid. See? Stopping people from voting. That's the Republican way. The bill would also end the practice of where the registered voter can vouch for an unregistered voter at the polling place under oath and prohibit cities from using ranked choice voting for local offices, something the city of Minneapolis and other municipalities currently use and others are considering. In a statement after the Wednesday vote, Kiffmeyer said the changes would be help maintain the extremely important integrity of our elections. No, it wouldn't. It'd basically be stopping people from voting. Can I call her Schmeagle? What I'm talking about? Yeah. You know, Lord of the Rings. Precious. Yeah. That's Mary Kiffmeyer. We'll just go with that. One final thing I wanted to set up here because they did finish up finally the testimony today. So after the breathing specialist said, no, he did not, you know, George Floyd did not die of fentanyl because he would have had to have fallen into a coma before he died of fentanyl. He didn't die of anything else outside of having the air crushed out of him by police officers, namely Derek Chauvin by putting his weight on the back of his knee. After the drug expert came in and said, not only did George Floyd not have a lot of drugs in his system, he had basically a prescription level of these drugs, less than most DUIs, so that didn't cause the problem. He basically went after the last, he was trying to get the last, expert, the Nelson on redirect was trying to get him to say, so there was a chance that on the third day of the summer and the moon's in the right position, that it could be bad? It wasn't a good day for the defense day. But also, I'm going to say this. It's not going to be a good day for the medical examiner either. That's coming up soon. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.